Bonjour, bienvenue à ce point de presse mardi le 26 novembre 2024. Thank you for being with us here in Geneva and those of you who are connecting from elsewhere. I'm going to give the floor. It's a fairly crowded briefing with a lot of different topics. And I know that you know, there are a lot of questions on different issues. There's one that just came in on nuclear talks that are reported to be happening in Geneva. And on that, at this point, what I will say is what we've been saying all along, which is any questions on these need to be put to the parties who are participating. You know who they are, and you need to talk to them. So, with no further ado, I'm going to give the floor to Jeremy Lawrence. The floor is yours. Go ahead. You have two items.
Yes, thanks, Michele, and good morning, everyone. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk is gravely concerned by the escalation in Lebanon, with at least 97 people reportedly killed in Israeli airstrikes between the 22nd and 24th of November, including 8 children and 19 women. On the 22nd and 23rd of November, at least 7 paramedics were reportedly killed in 3 separate Israeli strikes on the south of Lebanon, adding to the 226 healthcare workers reported killed between the 7th of October 2023 and the 18th of November this year. These are further indications of just how brutal this war has been on civilians. The High Commissioner reiterates his call for an immediate ceasefire to put an end to the killings and the destruction. Israeli military action in Lebanon has caused wide-scale loss of civilian life, including the killing of entire families, widespread displacement, and the destruction of civilian infrastructure, raising serious concerns about respect for the principles of proportionality, distinction, and necessity. The Lebanese armed group Hezbollah has also continued to fire rockets on the north of Israel, which has resulted in civilian casualties. Most of these rockets are indiscriminate by nature, prolonging the displacement of many Israeli civilians, which is unacceptable. The only way to end the suffering of people on all sides is a permanent and immediate ceasefire on all fronts, in Lebanon, in Israel, and in Gaza.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Any questions for him on this? I don't see anything. Perhaps you want to go ahead and with your other announcement.
A joint report issued this morning by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan paints a disturbing picture of the media landscape in the country since the Taliban takeover. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk says measures introduced by the de facto authorities fly in the face of international human rights treaties to which Afghanistan is party. The report, which covers the period from the 15th of August 2021 to 30th of September this year, details a range of human rights violations as well as worrying trends for media freedom in Afghanistan. Journalists, media workers, and media outlets are operating under a worsening environment of censorship and restrictions in accessing information. Women journalists and media workers face particular restrictive and discriminatory measures, profoundly limiting their ability to do their work. Media workers deemed to have crossed so-called red lines imposed by the de facto authorities have been arbitrarily detained for periods ranging from several hours to multiple months without due process, and in certain cases were convicted and imprisoned. The report states that since August 2021, many media outlets have been forced to cease their operations, whether as a result of direct pressure on them or the country's general economic decline and the withdrawal of much donor funding. Furthermore, many media professionals have sought futures outside, creating an increasing dearth of experience in the media sector. On the 19th of September 2021, the de facto authorities issued an 11-point guidance to media, forbidding, among other things, the publication of content deemed contrary to their own assessment of Islam and Afghan culture, or more broadly, to be against vague notions of national interest. Other restrictions include a prohibition on broadcasting music or movies deemed against Sharia religious law, including those showing women. At offices of media outlets, men and women must work in segregated workspaces, and men and women broadcasters cannot appear in a program together. In some provinces, women are not even allowed to call into radio programs, the only exceptions being for those on health or religious issues. Some representatives of the de facto authorities have reportedly refused to be interviewed or speak to women. They have found the attendance of male journalists at press conferences, they have favoured the attendance of male journalists at press conferences, while female journalists are either not invited, barred from entering the events upon arrival, or, if present, asked to move to the back of the room. On the 3rd of May 2023, in Nili City in Daikundi province, the de facto authorities commemorated the World Press Freedom Day with an event to which women journalists were reportedly not invited. On the 19th of March 2024, the de facto Ministry of Education invited journalists to attend an event marking the start of the new academic school year. No women were invited due to alleged lack of space. The High Commissioner says such all-encompassing control of the public space, or what is left of it, is suffocating. Not just for the journalists who try to do their essential work at great risk, but for all of the people of Afghanistan. He stresses that the Taliban de facto authorities must uphold Afghanistan's state obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights to ensure the right to freedom of expression without distinction of any kind, including gender. Central to this is respecting the vital role of journalists and media workers, including women, and facilitating the exercise in safety of their essential profession.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Do you have any questions for Jeremy, either on Lebanon or on Afghanistan or on other issues? Well, that does it then. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Yes. You'll bear with me, I think, today. It's just because we have some timing issues, and that affects a little bit the order in which people and topics appear. And it's not, they're all important and deserve attention. Next, because of a timing issue, we're going to our friend Christian Lindmeyer at WHO, who's with Dr. Rick Brennan. He's connecting from Cairo. He's the WHO Regional Emergencies Director. Perhaps, Christian, you'd like to say something by way of introduction. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Michele. And yes, indeed, Dr. Rick Brennan is our Regional Emergency Director for the Eastern Mediterranean region, a very hot and contested area. in these last years, unfortunately. He will be leaving his post very soon, going into retirement. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to have him come in today and give us an update on some of the hottest issues in the area and an overview on the attacks and on health and the lack of access. I understand he seems to have trouble connecting. He's trying again from the phone as we speak. I'm not sure if he's on at this very moment, if he managed already or not. Maybe the technical colleagues can have a quick look. There he is. So Rick, very good to see you. This might be a shaky situation as it's, I understand from the phone, but very good to see you. I just did a quick intro. Happy to have you here, and please, if Michele allows, I'll hand right over.
Go ahead,
thanks,
sir.
Thanks very much, Christian. Can you hear me?
Very well.
Okay, thank you. Well, colleagues, greetings. Greetings from Cairo and the WHO Eastern Mediterranean Regional Office. Look, you know, it's always a difficult time in our region. But as I reflect on some of the developments and some of the reports that have come out over the last couple of weeks, it's hard to imagine a more difficult time. And allow me to just sort of reflect on some of those developments. I mean, we all know what's going on in Gaza, close to 44,000 deaths now, close to 105,000 injured, over 10,000 missing. You've probably heard of the report that's come out regarding Sudan in the last couple of weeks, indicating much higher levels of mortality and violent deaths than initially understood. We now have levels of violence in Lebanon that haven't been seen for decades. The Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, in presenting to the Security Council last Friday, said we're seeing the highest levels of violence in Syria than we have for at least the last 4 years. And also we're hearing reports from Somalia now of an uptick in violence as we look at the drawdown of the peacekeeping operation there and this sort of transition period. So it's a pretty bleak picture. And in almost none of these settings, is there any political progress? In each of these conflicts, neither side to the conflict seems willing to lay down their arms. And in the last couple of weeks, again, we've had two Security Council resolutions, one for Sudan and one for Gaza, that call for ceasefires, both of them vetoed. How can this be, given the enormous levels of suffering and injustice across our region? And again, once again, the decision makers... decision maker who call the shots. They've inverted the principles deep within our own hearts and consciences should prevail. They've put politics and power ahead of basic humanity and serving the vulnerable. And it's just and it's not just the parties to the conflict that are ignoring this, that are making these political decisions. It's their international backers, and we have to ask ourselves why. Why is this, you know, still continuing? You know, in the meantime, you know, whole families continue to be killed, children continue to be maimed, hostages continue to be detained under unimaginable conditions, and women continue to be systematically raped. Just yesterday, a group of the emergency directors from the Interagency Standing Committee came and met with a number of us here in Cairo, a number of the UN agencies, and they asked us for solutions. And we said, well, the solutions are clearly political. These are political crises. They're only political solutions. We're the humanitarians. We're the ones that try to pick up the pieces. But we did ask. We asked them to advocate and do everything they can through the principles to try and get us better access to northern Gaza, southern Gaza, to Darfur. We did ask for more support for medical evacuations. We did ask for more resources, because we continue to show that when we are given access and when we are given the resources, we can achieve pretty remarkable health outcomes and humanitarian outcomes. We can meet international standards. But it's all dependent on that access. It's all dependent on that on those resources. Allow me to shift gears a little bit. Recently, earlier this month, in Doha at the World Innovation Summit for Health, WHO and our partners, the Qatar Foundation and the Wish Foundation, we presented a report on attacks on healthcare. It was a global report. WHO, over the last 6.5-7 years, has documented 7,400 attacks on healthcare in 21 humanitarian settings. It's not an exhaustive study. These are the reports that we've been able to document and verify. This is solid data. That's an average of 3 attacks per day on healthcare every day. We've also documented 2,400 deaths associated with those attacks. That's an average of 1 death a day associated with an attack on healthcare. And the impact on the delivery of health services in humanitarian settings is enormous. You know the figures. You know, only 47% of hospitals in Gaza right now are functioning, and they're only partially functioning. In Khartoum, it's only 12% of over 900 facilities are functioning to some level, and most of them only partially functioning. The reason we haven't eradicated polio in Afghanistan and Pakistan and more globally is because of targeted attacks, to a large degree, targeted attacks on healthcare. That's a very disturbing picture to paint. We have a lot of mechanisms to prevent and mitigate attacks on healthcare. We have international humanitarian law. We have political engagement. We have diplomatic mechanisms. But what the report concludes is none of those mechanisms are working. The situation is worsening. Of the 7,400 attacks that we've documented, not one person has been held to account. Not one. So impunity is rife. The neglect of international humanitarian law, in conflicts today, beggars belief. So in the report, we make some concrete recommendations about a way forward. We're calling for a global alliance on protection of health in conflict. We're calling for a special rapporteur on protection of health in conflict, and 7 other concrete actionable recommendations. So, the picture I've painted is probably a little bit bleak, probably very bleak. But I don't want to leave that as the departing message. This will probably be the last time I ever make an address to the Palais, and I thank you for the opportunities I've had over the years. What continues to inspire us is are the communities that we serve, and that irrepressible human spirit. I mean, we rely on the communities to sustain and prevail. And it's interesting when you go to Lebanon, when you go to Gaza, when you go to Sudan, they say, don't call us resilient. We're tired of being called resilient. But that's what they are. They don't want to be called resilient. They don't want to be calling on their own resources to sustain their families and their livelihoods throughout the horrors of conflict. They want an end to the fighting. So, our enormous respect and admiration for them, and indeed to the frontline health and humanitarian workers who continue to serve their communities under unimaginable conditions. So that's the good news. The human spirit, the commitment of people caught up in the horrors of conflict. But the bleakness is the fact that people with the power to make the changes are failing the most vulnerable people dramatically. So I thank you for the opportunity to present. I can't stay for much longer, but I just want to share some perspectives of the current situation in our region. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brennan, for your dedication, your service, for those very powerful words. I'm sure on behalf of all of us, I think they resonate very deeply from a health and regional perspective. With the words also of the Secretary General, he spoke today at the Alliance of Civilization in Cascais. Just now, I invite you to look at his remarks. in which he stressed that these are very, very difficult times where we see the social fabric under serious strain, and that everywhere tensions are mounting, human rights are under attack. He calls for the need for peace and for in various scenarios across the world, many of them mentioned by Dr. Brennan here, in Lebanon, in Gaza, in Sudan, in Ukraine, which we'll speak about with our friends from the IFRC in a moment. And he says we must uphold the values of the UN Charter of International Law, including the principles of sovereignty, territorial integrity, political independence of all states. I have a couple of questions from the room. I've got Isabel Sacco from EFE and Yuri Aprile from RIA Novosti in that order. Go ahead, Isabel.
Thank you. Dr. Brennan, I would like to ask, at the beginning of your statement, you mentioned, I think, a high level of mortality, a higher level of mortality than initially thought. I heard that. I think that you were referring to Gaza, but I would like to be sure, and I would like that you explain, you develop what you said, and what you were referring to exactly when you said that. And secondly, about impunity. Could you repeat the number of all these locations, ambulances, or medical staff being attacked? You mentioned the number. Could you refer to the timeline of these attacks? And on impunity, I suppose that our national authorities which should seek for justice. But in the case that it didn't happen, as you said, there was no case of accountability. So WHO is able to do something to seek for justice, to make investigations, or just to refer the situation to any entity that is able to act? Thank you.
Great. Do you want me to respond immediately? Or,
yes, please go ahead. Please go ahead. We'll take them one by one.
Okay. So I'm sorry if the points I made on the mortality weren't clear. The high levels of mortality, I was referring to a study that came out of Sudan. In fact, a study that was done in Khartoum, which demonstrates that the level of mortality in Khartoum is 50% higher than it was prior to the conflict, and the number of violent deaths substantially larger than reported elsewhere. So that's been a study done by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine that can be found online. The data that I was referring to for Gaza was that there's been almost 44,000 deaths and over 104,000 injuries, and that data can be obtained from our situation reports on the WHO website. In terms of attacks on healthcare, the WHO started a surveillance system on attacks on healthcare in January 2018. We've covered 21 countries. It's not an exhaustive surveillance system, but what's different about this surveillance system from other mechanisms for collecting data on attacks on healthcare is we have a verification system. So across 21 humanitarian emergencies, we have documented 7,400 attacks on healthcare over that period of time. So that's why I say it's an average of three attacks per day. And there's been over 2,400 deaths associated with those attacks. In terms of the impunity, national authorities have the primary responsibility to take action, to bring people to justice. And sometimes, of course, we know that, parties to the conflict are can be governments, and there's been a reluctance to bring perpetrators to justice. The international community has a responsibility in that regard. The principle of universal jurisdiction under the International Criminal Court, we do expect that other member states also look for the opportunity to bring people to justice. WHO's role is documentation and advocacy. We You know, we don't have a legal mechanism. It's not our mandate, nor is it our level of expertise to do investigations, to identify or perpetrators. That's not our role. We collect the data, we verify the attacks happen, we document the impact on healthcare, and then we advocate. We bring people's attention to it. It's up to others to do the investigation, to identify perpetrators and pursue the legal measures.
Thank you, Dr. Brennan. I know your time is very tight now. I just wanted to give a chance to Yuri from Rianovosti. He's got his hand up. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you, Doctor. I have, in fact, only one question. Can we say that the scale and the intensity of the Israeli army attacks against the health system in Lebanon and in Gaza, because, in fact, this is the most of the case that we are hearing about when we are talking about the Middle East, is it something unprecedented in the history? I mean, did we have any conflict before or now where we saw this scale of attacks against the health, or is this something absolutely new? Thanks.
Thank you, Yuri. Just because I know Dr. Brennan has a really hard out in 2 minutes, I'm going to let Emma also ask her question and see if he can perhaps answer two in one.
Thanks. If it's well, it's also on Gaza. Next month, there may be a huge void left by UNRWA. As you know, they currently take care of some of the health needs of Palestinians there. Have you been asked to step in? Could you? Would you? Thank you.
Thank you. So in answer to the first question, we don't have very good historical data on attacks on healthcare prior to 2018. I can say over that six-year period, we have seen the highest levels of attacks have been over the last 2 years, and they've been associated with the conflicts in Gaza and in Ukraine. But if I look at the countries, this is a global problem. So let's be clear. Attacks on healthcare occur in almost every conflict. So if we look at the countries where the most attacks have been documented, it's Palestine, Ukraine, Democratic Republic of Congo, Myanmar, Syria, and Afghanistan, in that order. So again, it's a global problem. I've been working in humanitarian assistance for over 30 years. I remember seeing hospitals completely destroyed in Bosnia back in 1993, and I could go on and on. So it is a global problem, over the last 6 years, it's been the last 2 years have been the highest. And I think the biggest concern is just sort of a reinterpretation by some of international humanitarian law. In terms of UNRWA, the official position is there's no plan B. There is no plan B. Now, WHO has received some funding to provide services to Palestinian refugees, as have other UN agencies. But the official position is UNRWA must be sustained. I know other donors are looking to step in. There is, no full plan B at this stage.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brennan. Thank you for your service. Thank you for being here today. On behalf of all of us here at the United Nations in Geneva, we wish you all the best for the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Always great to be able to present. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move to Ukraine now with the IFRC. Perhaps, Tommaso, you'd like to say a few words by way of introduction.
Yeah, thank you, Michele. Good morning, all. So today we have with us our IFRC program and operations manager, Jamie Wa. She's dialing in from Kyiv. She's working, of course, in the IFRC Ukraine delegation. And the main topic of the day for us is the current needs in Ukraine and the cross response to winter. Thank you.
You have the floor. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to share with you the latest on Ukraine. I live in Kyiv, and due to electricity cuts after 4 p.m., our team works in complete darkness in the office. When I leave the office, I walk home through streets with no lights and no working traffic signals. At night, I wake up repeatedly from the sounds of air alerts and explosions that have become an all too familiar part of life. Temperatures are falling below zero, but at least I have an apartment with heating. This is not the case for millions of displaced people here in Ukraine who have lost their homes and the basic security that most of us take for granted. For these families, survival is now a daily struggle. The armed conflict in Ukraine has been ongoing for almost 3 years, turning into a long-lasting and protracted humanitarian crisis. Missile strikes continue to hit urban areas, claiming lives, leaving people with life-changing injuries, and destroying infrastructure. In the last few months, Ukraine's energy crisis has worsened dramatically. Two-thirds of the country's energy capacity has been destroyed as electricity points and power plants are targeted in airstrikes. Even Kyiv is facing a wider spread power outage following the aerial assaults of the 17th of November, where substations essential for the operating of the country's three remaining nuclear power plants, Rivne, Khmelnytsky, and South Ukraine, were hit, further destabilizing the energy grid. Energy costs for consumers have more than doubled, and concerns is that heating shortages could trigger a new wave of displacements, with people fleeing both from hard-hit regions to other parts of the country and migrating abroad. Since the escalation of the conflict, the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, along with the Ukrainian Red Cross Society, have been working tirelessly to meet the growing needs of the people in Ukraine. As winter sets in, we have ramped up our efforts. We're delivering over 500 generators to power hospitals, shelters, and other critical services. Solar panels, power banks, and flashlights are being sent to communities left without electricity. Thousands of displaced families will also receive emergency housing material, blankets, and hygiene kits to help them survive these winter months. Despite these ongoing efforts, we recognize that the Red Cross cannot solve all the problems alone. Along with other humanitarian organizations operating in Ukraine, we have managed to provide assistance to 7 million people. Unfortunately, over a third of the people receiving cash assistance through the Red Cross say they rely on this support as their main source of income. And of course, this is not enough, nor a long-term sustainable solution. The scale of the needs is overwhelming, and with each passing day, those needs continue to grow. As international support declines, the most vulnerable are at risk, particularly older people, those with disabilities, and families in frontline areas. These people need our help the most. And as the harsh winter approaches, where temperatures can drop as low as minus 20 degrees Celsius, our actions will determine how bearable this season will be for families in need. We must continue to support people affected by the conflict. The IFRC is calling on significant new investments to address the immediate needs and to commit to long-term recovery goals. Now is not the time to turn a blind eye. Global attention and resources are waning and are for our IFRC emergency appeal, but the humanitarian needs remain. Together, we can ensure that no one is left behind in the dark and in the cold. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Waugh. I'm looking to see whether there are questions either in the room or online. Just one moment, we'll give it a second. I don't see any. Thank you very much. Thank you again, and stay safe.
Thank you.
We've taken you from Lebanon and Afghanistan to the Middle East more broadly, and now to Ukraine, and next we're going to Sudan, which is a much overlooked humanitarian emergency, tragically so. And we've got patiently waiting for us in Nairobi, we've got Leni Kinsley from the World Food Program. I hope you can hear us well. And
I can hear you very well.
Excellent. The floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for having me. So WFP food trucks arrived in North Darfur Zamzam camp last Friday, where famine was confirmed earlier this year. These are the first WFP food items that we have been able to transport into the camp in many months. These are carrying emergency aid for 12,500 people. Getting WFP trucks into Zamzam camp, which lies on the edge of Al Fasher that has been embattled since April, is a critical step. WFP has been pushing to reach all isolated conflict zones in and across Sudan. And these are also the areas where hunger is the highest and also the areas that are hardest to reach. My colleagues on the ground in Zamzam camp told me that people were lined up on the side of the road cheering as these trucks rolled in. They tell me that people in the camp are resorting to extreme measures to survive because food is so scarce. Families are eating crushed peanut shells, which are usually used as animal fodder. This across the camp, there are also parents who are mourning the deaths of their children who passed away from malnutrition. While the amount of aid in this convoy is just a drop in the ocean compared to the need, these trucks are delivering hope in to people in Zamzam who have been facing and battling famine all on their own, cut off from aid for many months. WFP, with our partners, have been providing locally sourced food to around 100,000 people in Zamzam camp over recent months, while we have been pushing to get access for trucks to reach North Darfur from other routes. The routes from Chad via Tina and Adre border crossings and from Port Sudan via Aldaba and onwards are the main corridors to transport aid into the Darfur region. More than 700 trucks are currently of WFP food aid are currently en route to communities across Sudan. This includes to 14 areas that are either facing famine or at risk of famine, and it's part of a major scale-up effort to reach millions of people in the country's most needy and isolated conflict areas. In total, the trucks are carrying about 17,500 tons of assistance, enough for about 1.5 million people for 1 month. As we speak, another convoy is on its way to Zamzam, and it's been on the road for over 2 weeks from Port Sudan, crossing via Aldaba in North Darfur. It's already traveled 1,400 kilometers across rough terrain, dozens of armed checkpoints and conflict lines. Now it's around 300 kilometers away from Zamzam, and this last part of this already dangerous and long journey is the most risky and unsafe. Another convoy has been on its way from Port Sudan to Kadugli and Dilling in South Kordofan, and it's also been on the way for around 2 weeks. It will be departing Kosti and White Nile in the coming days for the final leg of its journey to locations in South Kordofan that have received little or no assistance since the start of the war 19 months ago. All parties to the conflict, militias, armed actors, tribal groups along the way that are also armed, must allow these convoys to arrive safely. Safe passage and unfettered access are critical for WFP to be able to halt famine in Zamzam and prevent it from spreading to other areas. Since September, we've been reaching an average of over 2 million people per month with emergency food, cash, and nutrition assistance. So far this year, we've supported over 7 million people and aim to reach around 8.4 million people by the end of the year. Thank you very much, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kunzli. Just a reminder that without safe and predictable access and a steady supply of food and humanitarian supplies, we will see a dramatic spike in mortality in Sudan, including in children, and that the UN system as a whole, with its partners, have reached some 12.6 million people with humanitarian so far this year, despite these challenges. But obviously, the access is key. I think I saw a hand up from Emma. Go ahead, Reuters.
Thanks for the briefing. I was wondering what conditions on the ground have changed to allow you to do this major scale-up effort. Thank you.
So first and foremost, it is now the dry season. So between basically July and end of September, it was extremely difficult due to the physical road conditions. to be able to transport aid. Then additionally, we've received around 700 clearances from the government in Sudan, from the Humanitarian Aid Commission to start to move and transport assistance to some of these hard to reach areas. And bureaucratic impediments had also been one of our greatest challenges. And so those clearances came through. And then additionally, this particular convoy, it's WFP fleet trucks. So it was extremely clearly labeled, which helped to push forward access negotiations. And in a very complicated situation where you have many different armed actors on the ground, where communities are also desperate, and many, many communities are also just armed to try to protect themselves along these routes. So it was also intensive access negotiations along all of these routes that enabled us to get this aid through. And we need this to become the norm, not an exception. And as I mentioned, we have another convoy just 300 kilometers outside of Zamzam, close to Al-Fashir, which also needs to get in safely so that we can create these corridors where all actors on the ground, all communities, all tribal groups recognize this is humanitarian assistance, this is WFP assistance, and we're here to provide it to people who need the most and give hope to those communities.
Thank you very much. Let's see whether, I'm looking to see whether there are any questions online. I don't see any more in the room. Thank you very much for the very comprehensive briefing. Lenny Kinsley speaking to us from Nairobi on behalf of the World Food Program. Thank you so much. Thanks. Always welcome back here. Thank you. I think it's time to move to some announcements. We've got Thomas Kroll Knight here from UNECE, and after him we'll go to our friend David Hirsch from the ITU, who is online. Thomas, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Michele. So, fresh from COP29, countries must accelerate the decarbonization of their economies. However, the increasing scale and scope of industrial activities needed to meet the demands of the energy transition is bringing risks of accidents, potentially catastrophic ones. In response, governments from across the pan-European region come together this week here in the Palais, starting tomorrow, for the 13th meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the Convention on the Transboundary Effects of Industrial Accidents, known as the Industrial Accidents Convention. Parties will decide on the establishment of an expert body to address these risks, and we will confirm that when the decision is made. A dedicated report and seminar starting tomorrow, that's in room 7, will highlight risks linked to massive scaling up in production, storage, use and distribution of renewables, ammonia, hydrogen, and battery energy storage systems, as well as critical minerals needed for the energy transition, carbon capture, use and storage, and other technologies. This is backed up by a survey conducted with 22 countries in the region that highlights some rather concerning findings, namely that 3/4 of parties are only moderately prepared or even unprepared for prevention. Less than 1/4 of responses to this survey rated their country's industrial safety, infrastructure and current knowledge in dealing with energy transition challenges as advanced or state of the art, and almost 2/3 opted for adequate, while 14% as inadequate. So findings that underscore the importance of cooperation between countries to address these risks, as well as the relevance of the convention and other UN tools for chemicals, transport, management, handling, and energy cooperation. So just one final brief note, there'll be other key topics addressed, including satellite monitoring for mine tailing safety and disaster risk reduction, especially in the context of climate change. One final mention that this is a treaty which was born here after a terrible accident in Switzerland in 1986, which affected not only Swiss environment, Swiss health, Swiss nature, but also in France, Germany, and even the Netherlands. So highlighting again the need for cooperation to address these risks. So that's all from us. We remain available, as always, to facilitate contact with our experts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Some very important topics there. Let's go to, unless there are any questions. Any questions? No? If not, we'll go to David Hirsch from ITU. I think he's joining us online. David, can you hear us?
Michaela. There's a lot of interest in ITU's work with regard to space and terrestrial communications. We recognize that. And for that, we're pleased to be able to invite reporters for online participation to the plenary sessions of the upcoming World Radio Communications Seminar. This is next week on Monday, the 2nd of December, and Tuesday, the 3rd of December. The sessions will address the basics on topics ranging from how satellite and terrestrial operators file for radio frequencies, to global rules on harmful interference, and the inner workings of the international treaty governing radio communication, that's the radio regulations. Media advisory will go out on this in the next short while with the webcast information for watching online, and the sessions will also be available for later viewing via recordings. If you have any questions on that, please reply to the media advisory. You could always reach us at pressinfo@itu.int. There's also, as a reminder, tomorrow ITU will release the next edition of its annual Facts and Figures report at 3 p.m. Facts and Figures provides estimates on the number of individuals that are connected to the internet and will provide information on a variety of indicators that relate to that. The report will be under embargo until 3 p.m. tomorrow. There'll be a press conference to introduce the report and its findings tomorrow in this room, and embargoed versions, I should say, of the release and report are being finalized and will be available upon request. We'll send out a note shortly to which we just ask you to reply requesting the material under the embargo. We'd be pleased to send that to you. Any questions on that also, please, at pressinfo@itu.int. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, David. Further announcements. Well, you heard about the launch of Facts and Figures from David. In addition to the World Radio Communications Seminar, there is today in this room at 2 p.m. the launch of the World AIDS Day report with a number of different speakers. So I won't list them all here, but I think that you've got you've received a notice on that. 2 p.m. in this room. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the 27th of November at 11 a.m., the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, is launching the State of Agricultural Commodities Markets report for 2024. It's known as SOCO in the acronym. The embargo time is now being lifted to 10 a.m. tomorrow. On Friday the 29th, it was previously at 1:30. We'll be sending you a notice as a reminder. I normally also have a list of meetings ongoing at the Palais. I don't see it in front of me this morning, but should you be interested, just please contact us and we'll send it along. I did want to mention also the 29th of November, there is a special meeting at the Palais des Nations to mark the annual observance of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Our Director General at the United Nations in Geneva, Tatiana Valovaya, will open with introductory remarks and will read out a statement by Secretary General Antonio Guterres. There will be representatives also from the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, the Special Committee to Investigate Israeli Practices Affecting the Human Rights of Palestinian People and Other Arabs in the Occupied Territories, the League of Arab States, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Non-Aligned Movement, the African Union, and non-governmental organizations accredited to the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights, as well as the State of Palestine. So thank you. That's an announcement. It is at 11 a.m. in room 19 at the Palais, concludes at 12:30, and is being organized in observance of General Assembly Resolution 32/40B of the 2nd of December 1977. Thank you very much, Emma. And oh, I see three hands. So Emma and Yuri.
Maybe we're asking about the same thing.
Go ahead.
I realize that you're directing questions to the organizers, but on the Geneva nuclear talks on Iran, can you just say whether there's any UN involvement and whether Palais might be a venue? Thank you.
I cannot say at this point. I can tell you that there is no, you know, as of this time, the IAEA, for example, is not a party to the talks, and so we are. You know, encouraging you to be in touch with the parties, and there is no, I have no information of the venue, on the venue at this time. So, well, okay, désolé, mais pour l'instant, please go ahead.
One brief question to you and ECE. You mentioned there are 22 countries doing a report showing concern for the transition. May I have the full name of the report, or is it available on the internet? Thank you.
Certainly. We'll circulate that to you all immediately after this briefing with the link to the report, the list of countries. The 22 from among the 42 parties, indeed. So, thank you.
But, of course, Emma and Yuri and everybody else, if we do have information, further information, from the UN side, you'll know shortly after we know. Okay. Thanks very much. Have a good day.